Well, hey there. This is Endeavors. Hello, and welcome to episode 2 of Endeavors 2.0. We have a great show lined up for you today. You may have noticed if you follow my Endeavors radio page on Facebook that earlier today I posted the link to my video interview with Simple Plan. I was invited to go and interview Canada's pop punk heroes at the Peony when they played in Vancouver last month, and I had an opportunity to film it. It's something I've been wanting to do for a while, and I think it turned out really, really well, so check it out if you can. That interview will be airing on today's show, along with the fantastic author, conservationist, former park ranger, Jordan Fisher Smith. It's a fantastic, fantastic talk. And also, you'll be hearing from renowned Canadian artist, Roy Henry Vickers. That's all coming up on today's show. First guest is the author of Engineering Eden. It's quite interesting. It actually tells the story of a bear mauling in Yellowstone National Park and about how the ecosystem that spans Yellowstone to Yukon in the wildlife corridor and how sort of it affects us all. Not only is he an expert on bear attacks, he's performed the death investigation into the first Californian in over a century to be killed and eaten by a cougar back when he was working as a park ranger. And he also attained international visibility after narrating the great documentary Under Our Skin, which discusses tick-borne disease and made the Oscar shortlist in 2010. His name is Jordan Fisher Smith, and I spoke with him back in July. All right, Jordan Fisher Smith, hello, welcome to the show, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
So your book is Engineering Eden, the true story of a violent death, a trial, and the fight over controlling nature. Now I know in this book you talk about the death of Harry Walker, who was killed by a bear in 1972. Given your background as a park ranger, why was this story so intriguing to you?
You know, I think for a lot of the beginning of my career, I sort of thought that a ranger's job was to just defend the boundary, and that everything would good would come out of nature taking its own course inside the boundary of these protected areas, and as time went on, I began to understand that the history of these lands, you know, not only in the United States, but in Canadian national and provincial parks, was full of all kinds of effects and manipulations that people had already done, and that there was a long history of attempts to repair things when they went wrong, some of which themselves went wrong. And so I set out to write a true story about, you know, this business of trying to repair nature when we mess it up and how difficult it is to know whether we're doing the right thing. And I think because there's a lot of that kind of talk going on right now as, you know, with climate change and a wave, a huge wave of extinctions, people are beginning to think big about, you know, kind of stepping in and taking control of nature and operating it, you know, engineering Eden, so to speak. And, yeah, I wanted to write a true story and see how I felt about all this. And I came upon, while doing research for a magazine article, I came upon this, you know, cardboard box or a couple of boxes containing 1,745 pages of trial transcripts from this legal battle in the mid-70s over the death of this fellow, Harry Walker, at Yellowstone National Park, where he was, you know, killed and partly eaten by a grizzly bear. And as I read through it, I saw that the two of the greatest wildlife biologists of the 20th century had testified against each other about how you make nature whole again after you mess it up.
I think it was the Wall Street Journal that talked about how you use connectivity as a method. And that I think that's a really interesting phrase, because a lot of people, especially in regards to this upcoming election in the States, don't often make the connection between the environment and the economy or the environment and business. How do you see how those things are related and interconnected?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. And I think that at one point, Justin Trudeau said, during his campaign that he, he was trying to reach out to millennials, and that he felt that some of the youth was just disaffected with politics, certainly during the Harper administration. And I think I set out to make a story which was itself representative of this idea that everything is connected, that we're all connected, that our lives are mysteriously connected to each other. Martin Luther King, I think, said it really boils down to this, that all life is interrelated. We are all caught in an inescapable network of mutuality tied to a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one destiny affects all indirectly. So I think I set out to write the story with all its mysterious connections between the people and events in the story, a number of which are, as you know, rather gruesome grizzly attacks or bear attacks and other sort of miscarriages of justice in nature,
I wanted to ask you about the title, because you use a very specific word in engineering. I think people get the wrong idea maybe about what it means to engineer something, especially when we're talking about, genetically modified food, GMOs, and how that relates to the environment. What are you trying to convey by using the phrase engineering?
Well, I think I was concerned when I set out to write this book about a general trend I saw, which I've mentioned just now, which is people saying, we have already, in essence, taken control of nature. It's a fact that human beings are operating more of the nitrogen cycle than nature, right? That more nitrogen passes through our hands, notably in the form of fertilizers, than nature is cycling in the whole earth. The same is true for carbon, that we've really sort of taken control of carbon cycle. So people are going around now saying, hey, this is the age of humans. You might have heard this phrase or this term, the Anthropocene, that people are throwing around right now. This is the age of humans, and we may as well admit that we're kind of in charge of things. And instead of pretending that nature is autonomous and has its own way, let's just step in and take control of this thing and run it, operate it like a big ship or something, be the engineers of nature. So I think that's where that term came from. And frankly, I had pretty mixed feelings about the idea, To me, to say that we're somehow, that our, our activities, these things I mentioned, the sixth great extinction, which we're causing, and our takeover of the carbon and nitrogen cycles and other things that we're doing, the of oceans, they're kind of mistakes, really. They're not things we set out to do on purpose. So to think that we're qualified to operate the entire ecosystem of Earth like one big machine is to say that if you have a traffic accident, you are somehow then qualified to be a traffic safety engineer for freeways, There's a difference between having an accident and knowing how to operate something. And I think that I set out to weigh or examine these issues, in my book. I also don't think that we should stand back entirely and let, quote, nature take its course in some cases.
I think, especially lately, I find, at least in the American political system, that environmentalism has become a bit of a dirty word in some circles. Is there a difference for you between like environmentalism, conservation, and nature? And why do you think people frown on certain aspects of the environmental movement?
that one of the things that we've been exposed to in politics all of our lives is the application of the most sophisticated kind of advertising mentality, you know, the kind of mentality that you see in that American series of Mad Men, you know. So we've been subjected all of our lives to a kind of manipulation of the way we think by very, very smart and sophisticated people. And in this way, the concerns of what you're calling environmentalism have been painted as being somehow in absolute opposition to having a healthy economy. And, you know, it's simply not so. I always think that there is no economy on a dead planet, right? That we're living off the fat of the land, more or less, and off what are called ecosystem services, which create for us breathable air and drinkable water and oceans that make shellfish. You know, when you acidify oceans, they're now a third more acid than they were before the Industrial Revolution due to the movement of carbon into them, which creates carbonic acid. When you do that, you know, maybe you won't be growing oysters anymore, and they're a pretty good thing to eat. So I just think that the opposition between these two ideas is to be questioned, frankly.
And I think another interesting thing you talk about in your book is what the idea of wild is. You know, we always talk about wild animals or, you know, invasive plant species. But it seems to me maybe a little bit that term is a misnomer. How would you sort of delve into that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question. Actually, you know, sometimes people have said that the definition of wilderness is a pristine place, and therefore there isn't any anymore. And I think, again, that's a kind of sophisticated somersault of the mind that I don't happen to go with. I think the idea of wildness is actually very useful, because wildness is a tendency or capacity that's in nature, not just in, you know, in Banff or in Yellowstone, but in, you know, in the woods at the edge of town and in all kinds of actions that nature, through which nature will surprise us, you know. So wildness is a kind of unplanned or unknown quality in nature that I think needs to be supported wherever it still exists. You know, if there are peregrine falcons making a nest famously in the great cities of North America now, you know, nesting on ledges on tall buildings and living on pigeons, that's wildness wherever it occurs.
You mentioned cities there, and that I wanted to bring up a point in that. What do you make of the, you know, how has urban development, urban expansion, how has that affected the nature that surrounds us all, both the flora and the fauna? And we see these cities increasingly encroaching on the animals' habitats. How do we sort of preserve that balance between the need for human growth and the need for nature?
Well, that's another great question. I think that, you know, there's no clearer, you know, example of this than the Fort McMurray fire. You know, had such a fire started, you know, before Fort McMurray grew, or before it existed, such a fire wouldn't have been a big problem. You know, we tend to build into situations where we're in some kind of conflict with the natural processes around us. And so I think it takes a kind of imagination and careful thought and planning and a good respect for your own ignorance when we expand into nature. And I think we need to learn how to build things that we need in a kind of interpenetrating partnership with nature. You know, smart building and smart planning. And you know, when you push out a lot of suburbs, you have a boomtown like Fort McMurray, and good people that live there. And they're coming and spending their money and sinking their equity in houses there. You really have to think about what the boreal forest is going to do. And boreal forests burn big time, you know, and they definitely do when we have climate change making things very hot and dry. So I think we just need to think in complicated ways. And this book, I think, is an attempt. You know, there's a line early in the book that says, in 1859, Charles Darwin observed that plants and animals were bound together by a web of complex relations. And the very story in this book and all the people and places in the book are designed to be a sort of artistic representation of how complicated and web-like the world really is.
You know, speaking of Fort McMurray, I think that brings up another point in regards to Alberta, in that there's been a lot of discussion about the oil sands, you know, pipelines, and the best way to transport, you know, natural gas. How has that discussion sort of affected how we think about and move forward in protecting the world around us?
Let's see. I think your question is, how do we frame extraction of gas and oil in the current environmental crisis? I would just say that's a complicated subject. The tar sands or oil sands are first of all, economy does matter. That you know, people in Canada need to have some kind of future. They need to have some way of making a living. The tar sands are, you know, certainly not the most undamaging or efficient way to get oil, right? They're a way to get oil, but they certainly, you know, there's a lot of collateral damage, and it takes a good deal of energy to get energy out of tar sands. So, you know, for this reason, the tar sands has been very controversial. And I just think that the whole energy picture needs to continue to be looked upon with the kind of not simplicity and yay or nay and black and white, but the kind of complexity I'm calling for, and the sense of interrelation of everything that I'm calling for in this book.
Speaking of the book, you talk a lot about two, I think, what are two of the most iconic parts, at least, if not in the States, in the world, Yellowstone and Yosemite. What do those parks in particular have to offer the world around us, and why are those two good examples of sort of the modern conservation movement?
Well, I think it's another great question. I think the reason that Yellowstone and Yosemite are so interesting is that they're so early in history. You know, Yosemite gets created in the darkest days of the Civil War. On the day that President Lincoln signs the bill to create Yosemite, there's some 3,000 or 4,000 bodies laying around on the fields in Georgia, you know, from a battle 3 days before. And so right in the middle of this darkness of human affairs comes this amazingly sort of forward-thinking movement. And it's followed in 1872 with the creation of Yellowstone, before the Indian Wars were, if you want to call them that, or you could call them genocide, were even over. You know, the famous sort of Custer's Last Stand, where George Armstrong Custer and his troops are slaughtered by the conjoined forces of the Plains Indian tribes, happens 4 years after Yellowstone is formed. So the result of this is that people go into these national parks, and it's true for the earliest Canadian parks as well, before the science of ecology even exists. So, you know, I think people may not know, but some people in your audience do know, that ecology becomes a science right about the same time as atomic physics, kind of late in history for our own good. And so you see in these parks all kinds of things that were done early on that were just sort of the standard thinking about nature at the time. And then the parks ended up having the imprint of these various initiatives you know, writ large on the land. You know, we're talking about the removal of predators, the absolute removal of wolves from Yellowstone, and probably of cougars also for a long time, and the effects on the population of herbivores, which I go over in this book, that there was this giant population explosion of elk, which then just about destroyed the park. And because the elk were eating things that beavers needed, they kind of wiped out beavers and other species. So you see in the development of the parks kind of a little mini version of the development of the whole world and the advent of the kind of thinking, complicated and questioning thinking that I'm calling for now. But at the time, you know, what operated parks was what one scientist I know calls cowboy biology.
You know, millennials, I think, are definitely more aware of the effects on the environment and the climate than I think perhaps previous generations. And I know in the 2008 election, it was a very big issue. Is that a promising sign for you going forward in terms of the discussion that needs to happen?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think we've got to look to millennials for a fresh view of things. My worry is that the situation is sometimes portrayed as so dark that there's a kind of disassociation, that people disappear into their smartphones or their video games or, you know, other things because it's so painful to watch, frankly. And I think that there's always this need to, in some way, you know, get out there and find something that is beautiful and engage with it. You know, find a place that where your heart just sings. You know, whether it's, you know, the islands of the Haida, or, you know, or Banff, or, you know, Nova Scotia, wherever you are, there's some place that you just, that's your place. And engage with it in a way and understand that it's not over yet. I mean, the world is still incredibly beautiful and alive, and the game's not over. So I think what I worry about with millennials is that they would be so depressed by what's going on that they would want to disassociate. And I do see some evidence of that in some places.
Well, the book is Engineering Eden, the true story of a violent death, a trial, and the fight over controlling nature. It's out now. Jordan Fisher-Smith, thank you so much for your time today.
Dan, thank you for having me on the show. I really enjoyed your questions. Thanks.
Well, thank you so much. All the best.
Lost you there.
Well, thank you so much, and all the best in the future. That was Jordan Fisher-Smith. His book is Engineering Eden. And now we have a song from Simple Plan. This is the first track off their new album, Taking One for the Team. Here is Opinion Overload.
things exactly like I want to. What part of that don't you understand? Hey! And I don't give a damn if you don't approve. What part of that don't you understand? Hey! I won't apologize for what I feel inside. What part of that don't you understand? Hey! Not doing what you say, I'll never change my ways. What part of that don't you understand?
And that was Opinion Overload from Simple Plan off their new album, Taking One for the Team. I had a chance to speak with two members of the Montreal Pop Punk Quintet last month at the P&E here in Vancouver. Bassist David Desrosiers and lead guitarist Jean-Francois Jeff Stinko. And we chatted about their new album and what it's like having the same group of guys together for almost 20 years. Here's my conversation with Simple Plan.
I am really pleased and honored to be joined by two members of Simple Plan, David Desrosiers, Jeff Stinko. Gentlemen, hello, welcome.
Okay. Hey, how you doing?
Good, how are you guys?
Good.
Good, man, good to see you. It's good to be back here.
So the new album is Taking One for the Team. I had to listen to some of the tracks, and there are a few writers, critics out there that will say a few of the tracks are a bit of a departure for you guys in terms of your sound musically. Where did that come from, and how would you say that this album sort of came together for you guys?
Yeah, I would say that if anything, you know, on the album 3, our eponymous record, we took more chances then. And over the years, we decided that Simple Plan is an elastic kind of aesthetic that could probably, you know, bring us into places that, you know, that would be kind of uninspected, you know. And on this particular record, if anything, we decided to throw back even more to our first two records, you know. So it's very pop punk, very melodic, very energetic. But yes, there are moments where, you know, we're trying I Don't Want to Go to Bed, like a funkier track. We're thinking about I Dream About You, Singing in the Rain. These tracks are, you know, slightly left field for Simple Plan. The reality of it is, over the years, you have to maintain a foot in your history, in who people expect you to be. But at the same time, as musicians, you got to keep things interesting. So I think it's important to push the boundary, respect who you are. Certain times, you know, we probably went too far over the years. But I think as long as you do it with honesty, integrity, Simple Plan could be the vehicle for many different genres.
Well, and, you know, what does that say about sort of the culture of music at the whole that, you know, critics and those who write about music so often want to box bands into a specific corner or a specific genre, being like, this is what you have to be because this is what you became famous as.
I mean, yeah, that's always been a weird one. And to be honest with you, since the record number 2, like, we always, like Jeff was saying, we always tried to be sounding like Simple Plan, you know? And it's like, people want to put you in a certain genre, but at some point, like, Pierre's voice is very recognizable, and whatever he's going to sing on is going to sound like Simple Plan. I mean, that's what I feel like.
And the reality of it is, it's easier to box things, you know? When you have a friend that wears crazy hats, people know him as a crazy hat guy. As soon as he does it anymore, people are confused. Yeah. And it's suddenly the girl is the girl with the redhead. You know, and she becomes a pink-haired girl, and that's just weird. You know, it confuses everybody. It's just easier to box everything and make it, you know, easy to swallow and easy to understand. But yeah, I think being in a band is an evolving thing. It's a dynamic process. But we are still the same 5 guys. You know, that's an anomaly in this day and age of music. Same 5 guys kind of fighting the same way in the studio. We're still hoping to... We're still very much involved and passionate about what we do. But as I said, you know, people expect you to do certain things, and that's all right. I mean, it's part of it. You know, you wouldn't expect the Rolling Stones to come out with a Drake record, you know? And that's fair. You know, I understand that. But at the same time, if they did collaborate with Drake and do something crazy and really fun, I'd be up for it.
You mentioned that, you know, all 5 of you are still together after nearly 20 years, which is pretty rare these days.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's well known that that Kier and Chuck are in charge lyrically, but how much do the rest of you as a band contribute to the actual music of each song?
I mean, it really depends. It's a song-by-song basis, but I would say that the more we, the older we get, the more respect out of the others you get, and the more freedom you kind of get to, you know. For instance, there's this track called I Don't Want to Go to Bed, that has some kind of a weird bass line, like super funky, and
hey,
everybody's
saying?
Like, it's not weird anymore, but it could have been weird.
Yeah.
And we were like, well, you know, David, are you up for it? It's kind of strange. Like, how are we going to do this? David just walks in and pops like the craziest funk bass line. Nobody knew that he could actually do that. And suddenly, you know, the guy steps up to the plate and nails it. So the process is about that. We're challenging ideas, you know, as we get into the studio arrangements. We'll challenge, you know, melodic content, and that's the process. So it's basically, if anything, on this particular record, we went back to living together throughout the process of the record. We were discussing ideas, you know, like all the time, getting in there and kind of reconstructing the songs from the ground up and challenging the ideas. So the process is very, very much about a lot of discussion. A lot of trial
yeah.
and error, and yeah, I would say that there were tracks where, you know, the whole arrangement was there. We scrapped it, redid it again. Yeah, it's a song by song thing, but definitely a lot of discussions.
I wanted to ask you about I Don't Want to Go to Bed, because that's a very interesting track. I love the music video. I don't know where did that come from. They had to do Baywatch.
That came from Chuck's wet dreams back in the
Well, it was probably his desire to show him show his six pack shirtless as
that's
well.
That's right. That's right. You know, I mean, growing up, we with the age that we are, we've all watched Baywatch, you know, and
see, I didn't have money to buy Playboy, so that was the closest I got to erotic.
I mean,
content.
We had two really good reasons to watch it.
More than two,
the left and the right.
Yeah, but on every single actress.
Yes, that's right.
That's a lot of reasons, right there.
It's a lot of reasons.
I saw that David Hasselhoff has a cameo with Interview. Did you guys reach out to him and
yeah,
say like you want to do this?
Oh, absolutely. And the guy was a fair player, like super. He's into the joke. Like, he knows that people are kind of laughing at the whole like persona that he puts out, and he's super cool about it. And really, I don't think we could have made that video if we wouldn't have had the cameo. Like, he makes it so funny and so like tongue in cheek, you know, because it's kind of a fine line. It's a tribute to Baywatch, but there's a tongue in cheek element to it, and he kind of nails it. At the end, it's like, okay, it's a joke. You know, it's not like five guys thinking that they're too hot and kind of running on a beach. You know, it's clearly a joke.
And how did working with Nelly for that track come about?
It was a smoky situation, wasn't it?
Smoky.
I would say that, you know, the intention was very simple. We wanted to kind of bring the song somewhere else. And Pierre's voice, as David said, is pretty unique, pretty recognizable, but it's got some limitations as well. And I don't think that we're gonna hear Pierre rapping or rhyming anytime soon. So it was pretty obvious that we needed to call some help, you know. And we put a list together of singers that had, you know, a knack of keeping things melodic, but at the same time more, you know, urban, more. And Nelly was on top of the list, and he accepted, you know. And the guy's just super talented, you know. He came up with like crazy lyrical ideas on the spot.
Yeah, on the spot.
Just nailed them, harmonized them. Super musician, super nice guy. So it was cool to work with him.
You know, we're talking about this album, and I think there's a perception among some that, you know, if you watch videos like you and other sort of Canadian punk people, that there's a certain silliness that goes into it. How do you guys feel about that sort of representation, if you will?
Yeah.
It's because of Celine Dion. There's silliness. You know?
Oh, shit.
Silliness, yeah.
Yeah, don't worry about it. It is part of the heritage when you think about Gob, Sum 41. I think it's kind of a, I don't know how do you say that, a tradition, you know? But at the same time, we've done very serious videos, Perfect. We've done Crazy, Untitled. Yeah, I think it's important to balance it out. And I think as a band, you know, you're showcasing your personalities. A lot of fans love the music, but also love, you know, what we bring out, what we say, and how we say things. So yeah, I think it's fun to poke fun at yourself. And when you have a song like I Don't Want to Go to Bed, you could take it literally, and make a really shitty video, you know, a very kind of like modern pop video, or you can make it a little more fun, and that's the avenue that we chose to take. So I mean, it's a case by case thing, but it's always fun to use the imagery of a video to bring people into like a different vibe than what the lyrical content naturally brings you to.
Given that you guys have been together now for you know, the same group of guys for 17 years, do you ever think about like how you survived together, and you know, if what would you be doing if you weren't doing this at all?
I would probably be a pilot.
Oh yeah?
Yeah. I want to be a pilot eventually, but I'd probably be like a commercial pilot or something.
You know what? I had a dad of one of my very close friends told me, dude, just put all your eggs in one basket and just go for it. You know, because when you're actually kind of maybe there, maybe that way, what ends up happening is you're not passionate about anything. So for me, it was all about Simple Plan. It was about music. And I just went like full on, you know. But you could do what ifs forever. You know, I'm in this band and I'm going to keep going as long as, you know, people want to hear us. We're good friends. We still get along. We're still very passionate about it. So, yeah, we're going to keep going. And as far as what I could have done, or so many things, you know. And you know what? Now people live longer than ever. Maybe I'll be able to go back to school. And no, that's not going to happen. But you know what? Like, there's so many options that I could do. You know, I love doing business. You know, I've had ventures. I still will have ventures, you know, business ventures. Yeah, I think it's a passionate world. It's a fun world, and I'm going to try different things, you know.
Finally, would you, if you could pick one song off of Taking One for the Team that was your favorite, do you think you could pick one?
It's very difficult, but I would say that, let me think. I like the faster ones. Like, I love Farewell, Nostalgic. Opinion Overload is actually pretty cool. I'll tell you why. We needed that song to start the show. A kick-ass, fast, energetic song. And that song is exactly the answer to that. That was the mission statement, you know? And the song is also about, lyrically, you know, you're on social networks all the time. You're always, like, answering fans, getting their feedback. And at some point, it's like, pretty confusing, you know? Do you like that record or you don't? What is it? Like, what's your opinion? And at some point, you just get pretty confused and you have to shut it down. And you have to go back to yourself and to the band and be like, what is it that we want to do? Without anybody's, you know, telling us what to do, what do we want to do? And that's where the record took us.
For me, it would be Kiss Me Like Nobody's Watching.
That's a good one.
I just like that song. It's got a good vibe. It reminds me a bit of Tom Petty. And yeah, I don't know, it's nice, it's refreshing, it sounds fresh to me.
Well, the new album is Taking One for the Team. Jeff, David, thanks so much, guys.
Thank
you. Thanks
for doing this. Cheers.
And now here is David's favorite song off the album. This is Kiss Me Like Nobody's Watching. that was Kiss Me Like Nobody's Watching. My final guest is somewhat of a renowned figure, let's call him that here in Canada. He is a painter, a printmaker, carver, speaker, author, and well-respected leader in the First Nations community. He is the recipient of the Order of British Columbia, Order of Canada, a Queen's Golden Jubilee Medal, and an honorary doctorate of letters from York University. He owns the Eagle Eyrie Gallery in Tofino, BC, and his award-winning work can be found in collections and galleries around the world. He has recently been collaborating with author Robert Lucky Budd on a series of books, biographical books, and the last is Peace Dancer. He is Roy Henry Vickers, and I spoke to him back in June. It is my privilege to be joined on the phone by Roy Henry Vickers and Lucky Budd. Gentlemen, hello, welcome to the show, thank you.
How do you do? Roy Vickers here. Glad to be here with Lucky.
Hi. So, Roy, this is a big event celebration. We can call it coming up. How did this whole project start for you? Do you remember?
Which project? The project of the books?
Yeah. The Peace Dancer. Is that what they're calling it here? Yeah. Is that what it's called? Peace Dancer? That's what the information they gave me.
I take it you haven't had your copy of the book arrived to you yet, hey?
No, they just sent me a giant press. They just sent me a big press release.
Okay.
They told me it was called Peace Dancer. Do I have the right information or?
Yes, this book is called Peace Dancer, and it is the fourth book in the Northwest Coast series that Roy and I have been working on for the last 4 years.
Right. Okay. Yes. So how did Peace Dancer come to be?
I'll let you take that one, Lucky.
Okay. Well, Peace Dancer is book four in a series of Northwest Coast legends that Roy and I have been working on for the last 4 years. The first started with Raven Brings the Light in 2013, which was followed by Cloudwalker in 2014, which was followed by Orca Chief last year, and then this year is book number four, and the final book in the series, which is called Peace Dancer. And it is a flood story, which adds to the canon of global flood stories. It's a story from the Northwest Coast.
You've been doing this, you know, 50 years or so. What first got you interested, you know, in art and storytelling?
Dan, are you even interested in doing this interview?
Yes.
Okay. I've been doing it for 42 years. And storytelling is just part of my expression as an artist. And a number of years ago, I went through a transformation as an artist and came to understand who I am and all of the hard work that I put into what I do over the years, and realized that I could use my personal voice as well as my gift as an artist. And so embarked on an expansion of my career in artistic expression as a storyteller.
Now I know you've had your own challenges. You had drug addiction, you had poverty. I'm curious as to how those struggles have, and those, you know, the challenges you've overcome, how those have helped you creatively over the years.
Well, I'm not sure. That's not something for me to speak about, because I'm not quite sure how it all... First of all, I don't know poverty. I don't believe I ever was an experiencer of poverty. I experienced not having any money, but I don't see that as poverty.
Okay.
Lucky's my biographer, and that would be something he could speak to more than me.
Yeah, I've been working on Roy's biography now for 5 years, almost 5 years, and that is actually how this Northwest Coast series of legends came about. So I think that what Roy's challenge has been and what his mission has been with his art from the very beginning is to communicate to the world the beauty and the power of the peoples, places, and cultures of the Northwest Coast. And so how specifically his drug addiction or any of addictions or anything he's overcome has influenced his art, I don't think it's really swayed him off course with what his initial mission was, his personal challenges aside. I think he just finds so much joy in doing his art. That would be my perspective on that question.
All right. Okay. Yeah. No, it's now I know, Roy, I was reading that part of your interest in art was due to the a man known as Wilson Duff. How did he and I know specifically he helped you, I think, with the totem poles that you've done a lot of. How did he come to influence you in your studies, in your art?
Well, he didn't really. We have two. You maybe have him confused with William West, who was my art teacher in high school. What I came across in high school in Victoria at Oak Bay High School was discrimination. And I'm very careful to use the word discrimination and not racism. I believe there's only one race of human beings in this world, and we all belong to that race. So I don't. It's an ignorant term. So let's use discrimination. And when I realized that people saw me different to them than all the non-Native kids in Oak Bay, I was the only First Nations kid there, I embarked on a journey to find out who I was. And that led me to the BC Provincial Museum that's now the Royal BC Museum. And in one of my many, many, many trips to the museum, Wilson Duff approached me, and he was the director of the museum at that time, and he asked me who I was. And when I told him who I was and where I was from, he said, "Well, that's interesting. I'd like you to come into my office." So I went into his office. He went over to a filing cabinet and brought out a picture of my great-grandfather and asked me if I knew who it was, and I did not. And once I saw my lineage going back to this chief, Amos Collinson, in the village of Kitkatla, I was on my way to a journey of learning about First Nations peoples of British Columbia, especially of northern BC. And I continued to be on that journey. And that's what actually sparked my interest in the art eventually, was that I could actually do this artwork. But in the beginning, it was Wilson showing me what the uniqueness of who I was. And that was that I was Haida, Tsimshian, Kwajalein, and English.
That actually brings us to Peace Dancer in a way, because there's an image in the book, the final image in the book, is an image of the Peace Dancer, and it is based on that photograph of Amos Collinson.
What was that, you know, when Wilson first showed you this, and you sort of had this flood of history and heritage, what was that experience like for you, just as a First Nation, as an artist?
Well, I wasn't really an artist then. I was a young First Nations kid lost in the city of Victoria, and it gave me an insight into who I was and the importance of the culture of my father's people. And that, along with my art teacher, William West, helped me to begin studying the First Nations peoples of British Columbia and instilled in me a pride in who I was and what my ancestral roots were in British Columbia.
Now I know some of the big work is the totem poles that you created for the games back in 1994. Totem poles, I think, for me anyway, are I really enjoy looking them and you know, looking, seeing all the different designs on them. What do you enjoy about creating totem poles, and what do they mean to you as someone who is a First Nations?
Well, they mean what do they mean? The totems are the iconic artistic expression of First Nations peoples of British Columbia. So I guess that's what they mean to me more than anything else. And also they have helped me to realize that I can do this myself. And so the totems and carving the totems, including the salmon totem that you mentioned that's at the site of the Commonwealth Games, the Commonwealth Pool in Victoria, they helped me to realize the impact that I could make as a carver on people who are interested in the stories and the legends, like this story, the legend of the flood, which brings us to this conversation with you.
They're calling this the Peace Dancer, the final installment of the Northwest Coast Legend series. Lucky, I'm curious, as Roy's biographer, what makes him a Northwest Coast legend?
What makes him a legend?
Yeah,
I don't know if I'm really the what we refer to as the Northwest Coast Legend series is that all of the stories in these four books are stories that have been passed down through oral tradition for thousands and thousands of years, thereby earning the distinction as legends as a convenient way to talk about them. But they're part of the shared cultures of the peoples of the Northwest Coast. And we embarked on this project in order to be able to bring them to a wider audience through Roy's storytelling. So the fact that Roy is such a gifted storyteller and such a gifted artist is really what was the impetus to that.
Well, the project is Peace Dancer, and you will be launching it in Vancouver on Saturday, June the 11th, if I'm correct, at Studio 700. Roy Henry Vickers, Lucky Bud, thank you so much for taking some time today to speak with me.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, sir. All the best to you.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
That was my chat with Canadian artist Roy Henry Vickers. We have one final song off of Simple Plan's album, Taking One for the Team. This is Don't Want to Go to Bed, featuring Nelly. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you soon. Next episode will feature author Simon Choa Johnson, spoken word personality Jillian Christmas, and the music of Jadia Kelly. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time. Bye for now. Tell you the truth, I'm full of broken pieces, and all my nights are sleepless, and I don't mean to intrude. This secret, can you keep it? Won't give up even if it takes me all night. It takes my whole life, just won't feel right until I have you. Tired eyes burn, when will I? Tired eyes burn, when will I learn?
nightmares about your eye. Can't lie, I love the first sight. Love the first night I took my first bite. I'm insane when I take aim. Like King James when the mid range bang.
Love at first sight left me tongue tied. Just won't feel right until I have you. Tired eyes burn. Uh-huh. When will I learn? Uh-huh. Tell me what to do.
I don't wanna go to bed. I don't wanna go to bed. I don't wanna go to bed.